Good evening and welcome to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute's Friday Lecture Series. I'm Anthony Wong, Program Coordinator at the Institute. Thank you very much for joining us in person and online for tonight's book talk, Belonging in Higher Education, Perspectives and Lessons from Diverse Faculty, with co-editors Nicholas D. Hartlip, Terrell Lamont Strayhorn, and joining us online, Fred A. Bonner II. We're honored to have Dr. Hartlip with us for his sixth talk at the Institute, actually. And you can view his past five on our website after this one on www.aaari.info and also on YouTube if you search for us there. Nicholas D. Hartlip holds the Robert Charles Billings Chair in Education at Berea College, where he chairs the Department of Education Studies. Prior to Berea College, Dr. Hartlip chaired the Department of Early Childhood and Elementary Education at Metropolitan State University and Asian American and Native American Pacific Islander Serving Institution, ANAPISI, in St. Paul, Minnesota. While there, he also served as the Graduate Program Coordinator. Dr. Hartlip is currently writing What Can Be Learned from Work Colleges, an Education That Works, soon to be published by SUNY Press. Terrell Lamont Strayhorn is one of the most prolific and influential scholars in the fields of education, psychology, and the academic study of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. Dr. Strayhorn is professor of education and psychology, director of the Center for the Study of HBCUs, and principal investigator of the Belonging Lab at Virginia Union University, where he also serves as vice provost and interim dean of the School of Arts and Sciences. He's the president and CEO of Do Good Work Consulting Group and is also diversity scholar in residence at Harrisburg Area Community College, a fellow of AGB's Institute for Leadership and Governance, and board member for several nonprofits. Fred A. Bonner II is professor and endowed chair in educational leadership and counseling, executive director and chief scientist of Mach 3 Center at Prairie View A&M University. Dr. Bonner is formerly the Samuel DeWitt Proctor Endowed Chair in Education in the Graduate School of Education at Rutgers University and esteemed expert in the field of diversity and education. Prior to joining Rutgers, he was professor of education, administration, and associate dean of facilities at Texas A&M University College Station. Without further ado, please welcome Drs. Hartlip, Strayhorn, and online, Dr. Bonner.
We wanted to begin by just sharing a book trailer that we produced around our book. So I'm going to play it.
You and I suffer while isolated.
You and I long for that elusive connection.
You and I are eager to see ourselves
reflected in the whole.
You and I.
Who is more moral?
Who decides what is ethical?
Who gets to define the goal line?
Between you and I,
is there a line?
One that causes division?
Who is inside?
Who is out?
Who gets to belong? When our voice goes unheard,
we will speak to anyone who is listening,
forging new friendships
and making new allies.
When our presence provokes unease,
we master those spaces never meant for us.
When our thoughts and our dreams are not widely accepted,
we reach for the skies anyway,
while deeply taking root.
Right where we are,
you and I,
we belong.
What's funny is in this video, all three of us are the editors of the book. Now we're in the flesh. Fred's not here. There was a time when Terrell wasn't here, but we're all here, you know? And so you might not know that behind the scenes, but this is all personal. This is all personal. There's stories behind it. So we wanted to start with introducing ourselves. How do we come to this work on belonging in higher education? So first off, let me say, as a scholar, I am nowhere an expert like this man right here on belonging. So I was very grateful when he accepted to say, hey, yeah, I'll work with you. And so I came to this work because as a transracial Asian American adoptee, I don't feel like I belong many times in higher education. So it's personal. And I've done some work that I'll touch on throughout the presentation and make connections to my professional life as well as my personal life. And so I come to this work really in community with Fred and Terrell, and partners doing a project on belonging. And even their stories around even the proposals, right? Because when you write proposals for books, there's times when it's like, oh gosh, like I clearly don't belong in this space because some of the feedback is like really critical, right? And so that's where, getting support from my colleagues has been really special. So that's my story.
Well, first, I'm honored to be here, and special thanks to Anthony and the team for the opportunity to come, to my scholar brother, Nicholas, and to Fred, who's joining us virtually. I'm Terrell Strayhorn, and like Nicholas, feel particularly proud of this project because it is, I mean, we often use this phrase, a labor of love. But if you, with every turn of the page, if you get nothing from the book, hopefully you capture these stories, these narratives that, you know, share the beauty and the pain of people's journey toward belonging. And interestingly enough, in this place called education, where we often talk about people flourishing and thriving and living their best life and becoming who they were intend to be. And we do that and we talk about it without often laying bare that experience is not the same for all people, that the conditions that promote belonging and becoming, as my university president often talks about, are not the same for all people. And that quite often, if you want to belong, you know, I used to say earlier in my work that students would find a sense of belonging. No one finds a sense of belonging. It's not like walking down the street in New York City, this beautiful city, and you just find a nickel on the corner of the street. It's not like that. You have to strive to find belonging. So, in many ways, this opening chapter is particularly important to me because Fred, myself, and Nicholas sort of created this brotherhood. We didn't go to the same graduate schools. We have not worked at the same institutions. But if you're going to find a sense of belonging or create it in this academy, you're going to find, look for, hunt for people whose, creative imagination and energies are like yours. And you may discover each other at a conference. You may discover each other on email. You may discover each other on social media, but you will have to find someone to, sort of share community with that you can trust with your intellectual property in a way that they can, you know, we often say iron sharpens iron, but in a way that they can facilitate your ideas and encourage your imagination and affirm your experiences. And so, you know, if you haven't read the book, in the opening chapter, we each tell our own story. As co-editors, we read each other's stories. And that was, for me, particularly beautiful. And I'll stop on this point because Nicholas's story is, you know, starts with an experience he had at Ohio State University, mm-hmm. A place where I was a professor for 7 years, the Ohio State University for me. And though I didn't know that experience that he had, there's connections between how higher education can treat you and how higher education can both harness and support and enable, but also disable, right, and harm people, not in intentional ways sometimes, but sometimes through policies, practices, programs, experiences. And so I didn't know that story, but as I read his draft, I thought, man, it tightened and strengthened the brotherhood. And, you know, as editors, and this is in a series that is led by our other scholar brother, Fred, who's going to talk in a moment, shout out to Dr. Bonner, because quite often as authors, as editors, as journal editors, we have to create space for people to tell their story. It's not that people don't have stories in higher education. It's that quite often, in order for your story to sort of see the light of day, you have to change it. You have to alter it. You've got to make it palatable. And so what I appreciate about this book and about my colleagues is that we created a space where people could tell their belonging stories, the good, the bad, the raw, the ugly, the beautiful, the unpolished, the unglamorous, so that ultimately we hope people leave inspired to tell their own story. and I'll stop there.
First of all, let me say that I'm honored and blessed to be here with the rock star scholar sitting before you, Dr. Terrell Strayhorn and Dr. Nicholas Hartlip. We are truly the three amigos. We are brothers that go back a long time. So, and I just really, really appreciate them, appreciate the work that they're doing and the work that they're doing around belonging, but the work they're doing writ large across the higher education landscape. So sorry I couldn't be there with you all today. I love New York, so I'm bummed out about not being there with my good brothers. So I do want to say that I came to this work, and it's funny listening to both of my colleagues talk and share their poignant stories. When I look at my story, I actually finished my doctoral program at the University of Arkansas in 1997. So I just quickly wrote down, is 30 years enough? In 2027, I would have been at this game for 30 years, postdoctorate. And in 30 years, I'm still looking for a place, a sense of belonging. So I look at, from the very beginning of my career, I struggled to find literature. I can remember my chair saying, I went to him, I said, you know what? I'm actually going to change my topic. He said, what? He said, you've always been passionate about academically gifted African-American males. Why would you change? I said, it's just much easier to focus on that secondary topic I was interested in, the role of HBCU presidents. There is at least some literature out there. It's scant, but it's out there. When I say gifted African-American male in college, nothing comes up. And he says, well, you know what? Basically, since there's no literature to review, then you become the review of literature. So what I think you should do is reframe, refocus, and essentially think about what is going to mean that you become the expert in this particular field since it's not out there. So from the very beginning of my career, I've been trying to create a sense of belonging. So truly, if I had to encapsulate this into like a statement or a byline or some type of moniker, I would say, I've tried to create a sense of belonging in a place where, in spaces where I've not historically been. That's tough. You got to create a sense of belonging in a place where you have not historically been. And that is what we have done. That's what we're doing. But my work coming to this work has been really an entire rear trajectory, an entire rear sojourn, trying to figure out how I not only belong, but then how I get my research agenda to belong in an academy that says that I'm tangential, that says that I'm extra, that says that I'm orthogonal, that says that I'm not in the mainstream. So every since the beginning of my career, I've been on this pathway of trying to belong.
So in addition to the three of us as an editorial team, we were very fortunate to have Michael Eric Dyson write the foreword. And I just wanted to read this out loud. I think the voice is important. You can read the text there, but I think the voice is important. And he writes, we ought to learn from the best versions of deep belonging in diverse communities and duplicate as much as possible the virtues of such environments in higher education. We must foster deep belonging for those who have been ostracized, marginalized, or expelled, either from their own communities or from institutions troubled by their skin, tongue, sex, pedigree, or class. We must create an edifying version of deep belonging in the academy that shows that it is as much a moral as an educational choice. Our deep belonging will undoubtedly sow the seeds of someone else's undoing or their unceremonious unbelonging. We must scrutinize our forms of belonging and how they either invite or alienate others. And for me, Dr. Dyson's words really speak to what has already been said and my own path. You have to find, as Terrell has said, you have to seek out actively these communities. Sometimes they will be similar in composition. So it might be an Asian American community. It might be the African American community. It might be both and. It changes. And also I think of that, I've seen on social media, you know, you invite people, make the table longer. And so one thing you'll immediately know, as I can attest to, Fred and Terrell are very kind human beings. So put the scholars, titles, accomplishments aside. As a human being, at a human level, they're kind. And that is very remarkable because in my experience, higher education can be some of the most mean-spirited, wicked people in the world. And so you birds of a feather flock together, you find that community and you roll with it. And that's all I'll have to say. That's all I have to say.
I should add that Nicholas is also a very kind and generous person. And, you know, the other cool thing that happens, by the way, so belonging is a feeling. It's something that you can't find. You have to create, co-create with others, and that you'll likely find it with, you know, whether that phrase that's taken out of poetry, unfamiliar bedfellows. It won't be who you imagine will be the people who will give you that sense of connectedness. It might be people who share your racial identity, your gender identity, your religious perspective, maybe even your political affiliation, but it might not be. That actually in the interaction, in the engagement, that sometimes out of spirited debate comes, you know, friendship and understanding and empathy. So I remember, I don't know if I've ever even shared this with Nicholas and Fred, but we got together in Houston, for a writing retreat. And at the time I was trying to figure out where I wanted to sort of physically be located next. And so I met my scholar brothers in Houston, Texas. I was living in Illinois at the time. It was like -100 degrees. You know, snow was covering my, my driveway. And then I land in Houston, Texas, where it's, I don't know, 70, 80 degrees. The birds are chirping. The sun is shining. And I meet up with these guys and we're having good fun writing and recording videos. And I made a decision that day. I'm going to live in Houston. And it came through not just physically being in the space, because rarely will the space itself issue all the meaning. It's the connections that you create with people in a space that make you feel that sense of belonging. And so I think in higher ed, Nicholas is exactly right, that it can be off-putting, it can be hostile. I mean, these are words that we write, but until you've actually seen it, it doesn't always look the same. I remember being on the faculty at an unnamed institution when a scholar asked me, you know, early in my career, you know, why are you doing all of this? You know, why are you writing so much? Who are you trying to impress? This is a very senior, older, white, female faculty member, highly regarded in the department where I was hired. And she had already constructed a narrative about me that I was out to sort of be something and try to outbeat, outpace, outshine, you know, perform for people. And what I've learned over the, what, almost 18 years of my career is this, that maybe, you know, I try to fall on the side of empathy and understanding versus giving back the same negative judgment that people give to us, right? And so as I've started to try to understand, how did she come to decide who I'm trying to be and who I am? It is likely that in this profession, she has encountered people whose motive when they wake up in the morning is, how can I outsmart, outpace, outshine, outtrick someone? I can even imagine that one of those people that she met somewhere in her career might have been male, may have been a person of color. And so then she assigns to me a stereotype that she's come to believe, consciously or unconsciously. And so part of belonging is also about resisting the messages that you receive about yourself, both inside the academy and outside the academy, and still constructing for yourself a space and a place where you can become who you want to be. Like, she missed another alternative to her explanation, and that is, what if I was just a fun-sized black dude who was having a good time writing about the stuff that had been in my mind? So, you know, I appreciate, again, the pages of this book because it gave me another opportunity to lay bare for someone who's determined to believe what you are, what you are, what you're trying to do, what we're all trying to do, what this academy is about, what this research and scholarship about, that it's not about building monuments to ourselves. But for me, it really was about this epiphany I had that as I started writing, I'm showing the book so you can see it, you know, I love using the other side of my brain to create digital images. So one of the things that happened to me is I started studying students of color all across. I mean, students who live at the intersections of multiple identities. And I would learn that no student is successful on their own. Some of them benefit from faculty support. Some of them benefit from financial support. Some of them benefit from academic advising. Some of them have really, supportive families, constructed families, blended families. It's like a web of support is what I talked about. So I remember early in my career, sort of detailing these elements and talking about this web of support before I had the language for belonging. And I realized that what helped these students succeed is this web of support undergirded them so that every single message they received about themselves, that they're not good enough, they're not college material, they can't be a business major, they can't go to law school, somehow got counteracted through some aspect of this support. And it affirmed for them that contrary to the dominant message, I actually can be successful here. I actually can fulfill my dreams. So that excited me because in order for me to see that, I had to free myself, and no one frees themselves. I had to get liberated from some of the traditional models that I learned in graduate school that told me that, you know, people like most of the folks in this room, that we are, you know, deficit. We are lacking something. We don't have enough money. We don't have enough academic preparation. We don't have enough role models like us, but yet we're still here and we're successful. And this was sort of before the asset-based, strengths-based movement. So I had to find strength through community with other scholars, through reading outside of the stuff that I was assigned in my graduate school, like the stuff that is, you know, published through this wonderful research institute. I just say that to say that belonging is so much more than a feeling. It is something that has to be facilitated and nurtured. It does take a web of support. It does not happen automatically. It must be intentional, but it's worth doing because it leads to success.
Man, I always get healed when we do these because, you know, yeah, you're dropping knowledge.
Dr. Strayhorn is always a tough act to follow. He's always so brilliant with his comments. I just want to say that for me, when I think about what does belonging feel like, to me, belonging feels like that I don't have to apologize for differences or distinctions. And what I mean by that, when I walk into the room, I don't have to apologize about being green and being able to defy gravity. I don't have to apologize about being black, being bald, being whatever positionality that is phenotypic that people automatically think might see and say, well, he's different. So not feeling like I have to apologize for any type of differences that are perceived by the room, by the context, by the culture, by the environment that I'm in. That's one thing, but also feeling like I don't have to apologize for distinctions. Because across my life, I've realized that there is a tipping point where people seem to be accepting of Black males and particularly Black male excellence. So there is, there's a very thin line between when folks are okay with their perceived notion of me being a, the East Texas country boy that I am and being the, brother from the hood that some who don't know me might perceive. So that's acceptable. But then the minute that I get that award or I get that distinction or I get that journal, or I get that grant. So now I'm defying gravity. And now I become not somebody to be vaunted, but somebody who's a villain. So who does he think he is? So there's a thin line between in ways that people see or perceive me as a Black male. From my experiences, it's a thin line between being viewed as a brother from the hood, a boy in the hood, versus a Philadelphia Negro. And there are reasons that people out there in the ethos, they fear, they dislike, they have disdain, or they have reasons to feel like they need to oppress both of those characters. So belonging to me feels like I can come into a space and I can also be different and I can also bring distinctions and feel like I should fit and that I do fit.
Both of your comments made me think of just the tenure and promotion process, because, you know, you as a scholar, you do great work. And Terrell's case in his story, right, if you're doing too much according to the white gaze, the white stakeholders, the gatekeepers, then that's too much. But then at the same time, if you try to be small and you know, do less, that can be damning to you as well as an outcome. Mm-hmm. So it's how do you fit in that space? And that mathematics is impossible for us in places that you don't get that belonging. And so hearing why I said it's you know, medicine to my soul is because some of the chapters have talked about this idea of community, sharing stories, sharing, oh, did that happen to you? That's similar to what happened to me. So we don't get gaslit. So we don't go crazy. Mm-hmm. So when we're experiencing this racial battle fatigue, we have an outlet. So we don't just keep it in. Terrell talked about the beginning in our stories, and these were, you know, my story was a story about belonging, a story of unrequited love. And it's this idea that there was a time, and I'll be very honest, but my mentors, my family helped me better understand that my identity doesn't come from institutions. I could work at the number one institution, what any institution, but it can't love me the way that scholar friends, my wife, my children, aunts, uncles, family can. And so it's this idea that my worth comes from who I am. You know, having ethics, being kind, right? That's how I position that. And so I go through my story in the intro around institutions that never loved me back. As somehow, you know, if I wrote another article, or I served on another committee, or I smiled and pretended I was happy, that somehow it would love me back. Mm-hmm. And Fred, and it made me think, some of those videos are forthcoming, and we need to drop those videos because they're gems. Fred told me a story that if you enter, not as a whole person, you're going to depart in pieces. And so to me, it's changed my paradigm, like my humanity. What's really special, you know what? You know where my heart broke a little bit? It's because my brother Fred's not here, you know, because I love him as a brother. He's here virtually, which is good. And we're going to see each other in the future because we're doing another talk at an institution. But it's their humanity first. That's who I care about. I want to hear about their family. I want to hear about those things, those stories, these memories. Fred and Terrell, do you have things to share?
So much of what was just shared really affirms and aligns with what we know about sense of belonging. So just, you know, sort of retweeting, if you're re-Xing, whatever it's called nowadays, some of the things that Nicholas shared as well as Fred earlier. You know, belonging is not about fitting in. In fact, I wrote a piece in 2008 called Fitting In. It was one of the very first pieces where I started putting some of the language of belonging together. And I've had pieces since that I say, you know, you have, you know, it's a, your research is a journey and you're evolving. And in 2008, I thought it was, but true belonging is not about fitting in. Sometimes it is. I mean, I've met students who intentionally you know, are mindful of their dialect, their style of dress, the way they present so that they can fit into certain groups. One that stands out in one of the interviews I did on a campus in the Midwest, was a student who comes, she's a first year student on a college campus. She identifies as LGBTQ. She's looking for her community, her village, her family. She can't find them. So what she says she intentionally did was she dyed her hair a certain color. She puts a rainbow pin on her every day so that people might see those symbols and wonder things about her identity. She bumps into people who said, "Hey, I love your pin. Are you, how do you identify? Are you part of the family? Are you part of the community?" She says, yes. She makes friends. And she then says to my grad students who are collecting the data at that time that once she got connected to the people, she let the pin go. She let her hair go back to her natural color. She used it instrumentally. The reason why that's important is because we've got LGBT identity development models that would suggest that somehow this is artificial, it's not real. But actually she reveals that how she instrumentally used these mechanisms to find her community, to get connected to people who share things in common with. Well, I've heard the same thing from students of color who go to predominantly white institutions and don't feel a sense of belonging on their campus, but find it in their place of worship. And they're intentional about going to a predominantly black or predominantly Hispanic church or worship space where they start to feel those connections. And while there, they might meet other students who become their best friends or brothers or sisters or villas. So I think that one, it is not about fitting in unless you're using it instrumentally. It really is about creating those kinds of meaningful connections that we're talking about. I think the other part is, and Nicholas nailed this, where, you know, quite often when in very structural, traditional environments, you know, it's interesting when people can say you're doing too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And if you're a person who shows up in the world, I'll own my own story the way I do, which is, you know, I'm about a 5'6", 130 pounds if I eat good at Thanksgiving. You know, and I've got hair and I wear glasses and, you know, I like my clothes to fit me a little bit more than be baggy. And so because of that, I'm often perceived to be way younger than I actually am. Which means that when I walk into the room, whether I'm walking in as an instructor, whether I'm walking in as a professor, I'm walking in as a consultant, I already know, especially because the academy has taught me, I've got an uphill battle with most people, that some people could walk into a room and immediately be perceived as competent, qualified, capable. But for me, I know that that's not always given until I demonstrate that I deserve a seat at the table. And I got to admit, I mean, you know, you get enough years, just like working out in the gym. If you work out a lot, you can develop an endurance for it. You can go longer, right? But it's exhausting to have to do that. It's exhausting to have to, you know, prove your value. Doesn't mean you can't do it. I mean, you can do it and you can find yourself a very successful career in the academy. But just because you do doesn't mean you should stop and not try to change those conditions. Because we all have way too many friends, colleagues, brothers, sisters in the academy who lost their way because of the battle fatigue. You know, I have good friends who didn't get tenure and promotion because someone said they're doing too much while someone else said it's not enough. I've sat in rooms. I'm getting excited. Sorry.
Yeah, no,
so I've sat in rooms where, you know, in the same meeting, what was too much for one person is not enough for another person. Where 6 publications is enough for one, but 12 and a baby and time off the clock is not enough for another. So to those who are watching, those who will watch the recording, those who are in the room, I take that very seriously as a scholar, as a citizen of the academy, as a person of color, that, you know, tenure and promotion meetings, writing for people's, you know, external review is part of the responsibility we all have of being here. And that we do that work, for me, through this lens of belonging, right? That people shouldn't have to change who they are. Women shouldn't have to be ashamed of giving birth to a child or taking time off the clock for neither should their partners. That, you know, I've seen where people who are advised to direct programs early in their career you know, means you're going to have fewer publications. If you're advising a bunch of students, you're directing a program, those of us who are privileged to not have the direct programs early in our career, we can focus on books, we can focus on journals. But who's going to remember during the deliberation that that's the transaction that was made? Who's going to speak up and give voice to? These are phrases that we always use in our writing that I get frustrated with it because we give voice to everybody. But I mean, we got to give voice when voice matters. I mean, when you're in that meeting, everyone who's striving to belong, again, if you are keeping up with our conversation, it doesn't happen automatically. You're going to have to fight. You're going to have to work. You're going to have to strive to feel that sense of belonging. Because it doesn't happen automatically, quite often we need agents. And I'm looking at a room full of agents, of people who operate in different ways to create space for others. So for me, this book got particularly powerful, I mean, particularly personal, not because every chapter is for me, but because as I read every chapter, I realized just the beauty of it. You know, you can't really tell the story of belonging for some people without some artifacts. I'm speaking particularly to those whose sort of personal origins and cultural origins lie outside of this sort of Western epistemology that shapes the academy, right? So I identify as an African-American male. My mom is probably watching. I know my sister's watching. Shout out to my sister, Kim. You know, my grandma who helped raise... In my family, listen, I write books, but really, it's stories that matter. My grandma was a great storyteller. She would tell me about aunts and uncles and grandma, great-grandparents that I never met, but I could hear through stories. So I grew up respecting the power of the story. The stories my grandma told didn't have citations, but sometimes they did. They weren't APA citations. They were citations through a lived experience. And sometimes you need artifacts, and my grandma could show me a ring, or she could show me a scar, or she could show me a dress and say, this is something that she remembers someone giving her. So when you think about this book, I appreciate the fact that my colleagues and I were able to create space for people to draw cultural artifacts, sometimes emails. Yeah, some tables and charts. But sometimes there's a dialogue that's going back and forth between one of the authors and a mentor. And to create that kind of space, you pick up how belonging happens, often in dynamic relationship with others. Often through conflict and controversy comes the success of belonging. So again, for me, it was about not fitting in. It's about reconciling these messages that by some people it might be too much. If anyone in the audience has ever heard that, remember this, you're never too much. You're never too much. Just the way you are. You're everything you're supposed to be. Unfortunately, the academy has to grow to appreciate that. And to Nicholas's point, I've just, you know, had enough battle scars to realize I'm just going to do the work I do. I'm going to do it in the way I like to do it. And to his point, you know, institutions don't make people. Institutions, I say this all the time is in the consulting work I do. Students don't, what is it? Institutions don't make people. People make the institutions. If you don't believe me, get rid of all the people at an institution and see how many students will stay there. There's some student who comes to that institution because Dr. Bonner's there. There are students at Berea who go because Dr. Hartlett is there. There are students at Virginia Union I know who come because I'm there. Not all students, but some. We each play a role, but it's not just the professors. I mean, I've been at campuses where there are some students who go back to their institution because their coach is there. I was on the West Coast in California because Miss Mary, who works in the cafeteria, is there and she cares about them and she knows their dietary needs without even asking them. We all play a role. It's those strong bonds and connections that foster belonging. And that's really what this book is about.
So, ditto to all of the great things that Dr. Strayhorn just said. Absolutely. And my particular section, my particular focus, it kind of harkens back to my high school and undergraduate days when I was a chemistry major, and I was a music minor. All through high school, I actually played piano, advanced to state UIL competition in Texas, both years playing Beethoven sonata. So I've always had a deep love for music. And so I titled my section Prelude and Fugue. So one of my favorite musical forms. And it's interesting when you actually look up the definition of a prelude and a fugue. So a prelude is described as like an introduction. It's a musical form that's kind of like an introduction piece. And the fugue that follows is typically an extension of the introduction. But the interesting thing is most preludes and fugues are in the same key. I think this is one of the best metaphors, and it's very emblematic of what my experience has been in academe. I spent all of my undergraduate, master's, and doctoral experiences were in predominantly white institutions. And all of my career was spent from tenure and promotion. I was at University of Texas San Antonio, which is Hispanic serving institutions. But prior to that, all of my institutional experiences were PWIs, and Prairie View being my first HBCU experience. So I just have seen and viewed my career as somewhat of a musical adaptation of the prelude and the fugue. So if I looked at where I started here in the past several years, getting a full professor at Texas A&M College Station and becoming associate dean of faculties there, and then later moving on to Rutgers University and becoming the Samuel DeWitt Proctor Endowed Chair, and left Rutgers to move back to Texas, back into the Texas A&M system to start my own research center here at Prairie View A&M University. So moving from PWIs and shifting from Rutgers to Prairie View, it was a transition. It was a prelude and it was a fugue. And the thing about the prelude and fugue is that one is an introduction and the other is an extension. It doesn't say one is better than the other. It doesn't say that one is more raucous than the other. It says that in the same key, you have an introductory musical form that is later extended through another musical form. So my prelude at the Prairie View, at the Texas A&Ms and the Rutgers of the world, it gave me that introduction to the academy, to some of the things that I needed to see, that I needed to experience going through tenure and promotion, getting my chops, you know, earning my stripes in a Research One context to show the world that I could do it, that I could get full professor in an R1. And using that and all of the experiences that I got and taking all of that now into a minority serving institutional space where I can actually extend all of the introductory things. So I feel like early in my career, trying to belong, I mean, belonging, as Dr. Strayhorn said, is very contextual. So trying to belong at Texas A&M, trying to belong at Rutgers University, as opposed to what trying to belong at Prairie View A&M University means, very, very different in a lot of ways, similar in some ways. And a lot of people get it twisted. They think, well, you're a black man and you're in an HBCU, so you don't have to worry about belonging. Absolutely, positively not true. I think I've struggled more with belonging in my adult life and farther in my professional career. In many ways, interfacing with colleagues, not that Prairie View is difficult, not that I have problems, but there were some challenges because I made some assumptions coming in that I'm black, I'm going to a black context, so it's kumbaya, it's Wakanda, everything's going to be great, everybody's going to be the same, everything. And this is probably one of the most diverse places that I've been. It's hard to understand diversity in a place where everybody looks alike. So that is a very different type of, a very different experience with belonging. You know, what does it mean to belong as a person of color in a context that is, you know, BIPOC constructed, crucible of BIPOC individuals? So, yeah, so prelude and fugue is what I called it, because what I started in one space, I've been able to extend now here in this current space. One thing that I want to say, in teaching in the higher ed and student affairs programs, one of the pivotal models, one of the pivotal frameworks, one of the pivotal theories is Lewin's interactionist paradigm. And this is considered the cornerstone theory of student affairs, student development theory. And what this particular theory says is that behavior is a function of the person times the environment. And I use this particular paradigm a lot because I think it has such implications not only in higher education, I mean, K-12, I think in any context, when you're thinking about, you know, if you want particular outcomes, if you want a particular behavioral outcome, you really have to look at the people, but you also have to look at the context, the environment. So I always put this slide, I mix it in when I, especially when I'm talking about belonging, because if you want the outcome to be that someone feels like they're, like they belong, if that's the behavioral outcome that you want, then what are we doing to address the P's, the people? And what are we doing to ensure that that institutional context? So many times, one of the courses I teach is higher ed environments. And one of the things that we overlook many times is the impact and the effect of the environment. So it's going to be a very, very different experience about belonging in the HBCU versus the PWI versus the HSI context or the tribal institution or the ANAPESI. So you can just skip to that other one. The only other thing that I want to say, and this particular slide is a, this model, one of my former doctoral students here at Prairie View, she's actually graduated now and is actually teaching here at the university. So we developed this particular model based on a op-ed piece that we published with Diverse Issues. And what we posed is we hear so many times folks talk about code switching, you know, one of our sociological terms that we throw around a lot. We hear a lot, you know, code switch, code switch, code switch. You know, I feel like I have to code switch. I have to code switch. And that's not just about race. It's about socioeconomic status. It's about gender. So many contexts, folks feel like they have to switch out of their identity or out of their espoused identity into a different identity just to fit. So therefore you switch your code switching. That's where the term comes from. So we proposed a different model. We said, instead of code switching, what about code stitching? What do we mean by code stitching? And this comes from, if you thought about someone like a brigadier general, if that general, you know, if a Colin Powell, if someone, if they walked into a room, there would be no expectation for this brigadier general, for Colin Powell to become less than Colin Powell. There would be no expectation for him to switch out of his identity of being who he is to fit the context. So we said, each time a person of color, a person of a different identity has to code switch, it's like a little assault. It's kind of like, you know, this, a little murder that happens daily. Every time you go into a different room or a different space, you have to kill off who you are to fit. And that is defeating. It's exhausting. It is. So we said, instead of feeling like you have to switch out of your identity, how about you stitching your identity onto your lapel like a badge, you know, like a general stripe. So you got it there. So now when I go into this room, I'm going to be me. So now the space has to try to fit who I am as opposed to me trying to morph, change, become a contortionist to fit what the space is. So that was the op-ed piece that we did. I think it's like 2 years ago. But anyway, co-stitching as opposed to co-switching to create a better sense and feel of belonging.
Thinking about, you know, Fred's work and his model, it made me think of belonging in terms of Asian American transracial adoptees. So a former student of mine, now Dr. Suda, at Southern Methodist University, he and I have published some work on transracial adoptees. I'll make the screen a little bigger. And there has to be some kind of insider knowledge, some, you know, what we call it, emic knowledge compared to etic knowledge, because, you know, it's a phenomenological experience, you know, to be, in a position as a transracial adoptee is unique. You can empathize and you can read about it, but, you know, walking in a lived reality, right? So that's why these stories are important. And so thinking about higher ed, this multiracial model, that really Dr. Suda developed, thinking about nature and nurture, you have this biological you know, your birth, biological family and culture. And then perhaps if you're in a transracial, adopted live life, you have nurture, how you're raised. And so these models we've shared in some other spaces, like Fred, Dr. Bonner, he has a book on different models. And why these models are really important is something that all of us have said, but, you know, Terrell shared too, is, and Fred, is this idea that literature isn't out there, so we do need to create it and write about it. But it's also this idea that we're not a normative group, so the scales aren't normed sometimes in ways that are appropriate for our populations. Asian Americans, there's an underrepresentation of participants, right? And so statistically, we use these terms like there's not enough power. And so, you know, you have to oversample. Well, what does that mean, really, right? In quantitative spaces. In qualitative spaces, what does it mean? I think what it means in some of these chapters is that we need more research. And so thinking about this chapter in the book, these three authors were, and they currently are, diversity, equity, and inclusion leaders. And they've written, their experiences. And I have to read, something. Page 179, there's a dialogue, of a supervisor, an Asian American woman, and a different person. And so the supervisor says to the Asian American woman, "I want to give you feedback related to your work ethic. The energy you give off. If you want to make it, you're going to have more executive presence." The Asian American woman responds, "I'm not sure I'm following." And then the supervisor says, "Well, you know, in your culture, you were probably raised to be more quiet, a little passive, but that's something you'll need to overcome. I'm simply trying to help you." And it kind of gets to what Fred talked about, you know, his positionality. How do people construct him? Is he a country boy or is he a urban dweller? Kind of what Terrell shared of his phenotype, you know, when he's constructed as his age, right? Which is a real thing. I mean, in the academy, yeah, we have ageism against old people, but we also have adultism that can creep in. How do we treat, right? And this notion of to be a professor, you must be old and of a certain stature, right? All of it really culminates. I had the similar experience. You know, Fred and Terrell have held very senior roles, very, you know, high roles, in administrative roles. And as someone who has aspirations for decanal leadership, I'd like to be a dean one day. And I remember having a debrief after doing a first round interview, and the headhunter said, I said, "What's the feedback?" You know, and they said, "Oh, you did great." I'm like, clearly I didn't, because I didn't get a campus interview. He said, "Well, what I mean by that is they all thought you were lovely and nice." I said, "Okay, what's wrong with administrators that are nice?" They said, "Well, they need somebody to, they're afraid that you can't be an asshole." That's what he said. You're too nice as a colleague. That might work as a chair, but it's not going to work as a dean. And that's what the language was. And I said, "Interesting. Interesting. So I'm constructed as too nice. Interesting, right?" And we have these stereotypes, angry black man, angry black woman. When is enough? And so I've kind of taken the same approach that Terrell has. I'm going to be who I am in all spaces. And my time will come when an institution sees that, accepts Nicholas is who he is, and I'll get that opportunity. I'm not going to contort and change, because what happens when you do that is you get to that space and you lose all sight of who you are, and you're dead on arrival. Really, it goes back to what Fred had said, told me. He said, you know, if you don't enter whole, you'll leave in pieces. So, Terrell or...
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what this last sort of segment reminds me of is, and this was a decision that was made very early in the process for this book, and I will attribute it to Nicholas because by the time I read the proposal, we were already going down this path, and that is to use the power of autoethnography. And so, you know, in both the opening chapter, but also in my chapter about community colleges, you know, I was quantitatively trained as a graduate student. I had courses in qualitative methods, but that's not how I started my career. I used to call myself a hardworking student of qualitative methods. But when I, you know, sort of got the challenge, I thought, man, I want to know more about autoethnography. So I threw myself into this deep dive of what is autoethnography, what is it not, what does it add to our ability to understand and access knowledge as researchers, as scholars, as writers. So in this chapter, I call out, just because it aligns with what Nicholas just said, that autoethnography is the process of making sense of one's own experiences through, listen to this, one's own personal narrative. It is it's the power to give voice to one's own personal cultural experiences, which for a lot of people has to be really liberating, and that you get to use your story as the data source. And so to Nicholas's point, you know, I've had the same experience where I might go somewhere, maybe being considered for a job, and someone might look at my size or look at my shape or, you know, look at the fact that I spend most of my time trying to smile, right? Because one, I'm a black man in America, and you can't walk around looking upset and angry because people will construct you that way. And here's the other thing that we've got to be honest about. And there's a consequence for being perceived as angry or mad. I have seen where just the fold of my arms is made to mean I'm not interested, that I'm angry, I'm mad, I'm upset with something that's being discussed. I might also be thinking about what I'm going to eat for dinner, just like everybody else, right? But I have to appreciate that as all of it comes together, that's what happens to all of our bodies in this world and certainly in this academy. And so as a person who's, I've been a provost, I've been a vice president, I've directed centers, you know, someone might look at me and say, well, you're young and you're fun and you're whatever, and you can't be hard. But autoethnography gives me the opportunity to, if the citations won't count and the CV won't count and the record of success won't count and the references won't count, to tell a story about a time when I was a vice president and I had a group of deans that acted waywardly and did something against what we had been deciding to do. And I realized, and you're a person who aspires to be a dean, you know, as a vice president who oversees deans, I thought, listen, I'm deliberative, I'm democratic, I want your input, I love team, there's no I in team, but once we've decided where we're going, I am looking for a team that will be collegial, that will cooperate, that will co-labor. I'm not going to do it all by myself, I'm going to do it with you. But the moment I realized that my team decided to go a different direction, I've got a problem on my hands. So, no, I was not, what'd you say? What's the word the guy told you? Because my mom is watching, I can't say that word.
Yeah. Asshole. I had to be an asshole.
I'm not going to be that. Sorry, Mom. But listen, I'm not going to be that, nor do I have to be effective. And for anybody who's watching, anybody who's listening, you don't have to be what people want you to be effective. What we have to do quite often is call people's attention back to the real KPI, the key performance indicator. I don't have to be that. I have to be effective. I don't have to be that. I got to be a decision maker. I don't have to be that. I've got to be accountable. And so what happened was I got with my assistant. I said, look, I'm not going to fight my own team. Get me 5 laptops. Meet me in the library. And I brought my team of deans in there. I said, listen, as your vice president, I'm here. I'm down for the team. I'm down for the cause, but I'm not going to fight my own team. I've got 5 laptops here. I will accept the resignation of anybody who does not want to be a part of this team. You don't have to go back to your office and write it. I got a laptop for you. You can write it right here. Mm-hmm. Stay on the faculty, but you're not going to be a dean. And I didn't say it nastily, I didn't say it hostily, and I meant it. And they said, well, what will happen to my salary? Hold on a moment. I called the CFO. Come in here. They want to talk about their salary. Because here's what I'm not going to do. We got too much to do in the academy for our students than to fight each other. The resume does not allow you space to tell that story. The, you know, rarely do you put that on social media. References won't necessarily know that, but the power of the story, the power of autoethnography, is you get to tell the story to demonstrate the effectiveness that hopefully can lead to the outcome you want. So the other part of this for me is unearthing that so much of what happens to us doesn't get captured in these very traditional ways that the academy sees. You know, it's not in the books. It's not in the journal calls. It's actually there. The last thing I'll say, because I hear it also as a theme throughout the chapters, is, and my mom, who's watching, you would often tell me when I was going through one of my own belonging battles, she was like, you know, one day you'll be grateful this happened. I was frustrated with that, because when you don't get the job, or you don't get selected for the team, you don't get the call back. You break up in the relationship. I don't know what your situation might be, right? You don't actually want to celebrate that. But I got to tell you something, that my research is very clear that there is enormous power for belonging that comes from pain. Not the pain that cripples and suffocates and hurts and kills, but difficulty, struggle, test. There's a lot of power in that pain. And so the stories that I draw upon in my belonging research from surveys and from interviews with students who trust me with their stories is this: you don't get to the door of belonging showing up in the way like we all show up without passing through a hallway of haters.
That's deep. Yeah.
You don't get to the door of belonging without having to work through the pool of your pain. And what happens is, in graduate school, we're often taught to hide our pain, conceal our pain, don't talk about it, change your dialect, change your style of dress, you know, stand up, you walk through, you know, whatever it is, you, to get you divorced from the source of your power. This, I hope, becomes inspiration for people to turn to that experience as your story, and to draw from it the strength that it gives, so that you can offer it to someone else who will then go and find that sense of belonging in the academy.
That's so humanizing, because hearing people's stories, you know, like I always talk to these brothers and hear their stories. I'm like, oh, you mean y'all, because they're more senior than I. Oh, y'all experienced that? Okay, you're still standing? Okay, I can stand. Fred, do you have, Fred, anything, thoughts on this before we transition to Q&A? I know your work on resilience. I mean, I know there's a lot of things swirling in your mind.
Hold off for the Q&A to see if folks, have any questions for me.
Okay. Well, we'll have a question and answer, I put some resources here, some of the models that Fred and has done, and then, I mean, Dr. Strayhorn, his work. I didn't know. Got to check out his new journal. is pretty exciting. So, any questions? And I'm not sure, Anthony, the people on Zoom or in person, if they all can participate, but. And then also a shout out. I'm not sure if Dr. D's Kendall is in the room. There's some chapter contributors in the Zoom as well. So it's been well attended. And thank you for the audience. Mm-hmm. So this is the time where you can share your stories, ask questions.
Please.
Do you want us to introduce ourselves?
Yeah.
Greetings, Dr. Hartlip, Dr. Strayhorn, and the more than illustrious Dr. Fred A. Bonner. My whole full name is Dallas Lee Bell. Yes, you hear Nassau, Bahamas when I speak English. And I have two questions that are linked together. Dr. Strayhorn, are you familiar with the short story of the bird in the egg? Do you know that one?
Not off the top of my head, no.
We'll talk afterward.
Okay.
Second question. This is for Dr. Fred Bonner. This could be a question for you too, Dr. Strayhorn.
Okay.
Historically black colleges and universities and their siblings, predominantly black institutions, are struggling not only to recruit African heritage males, that takes in the diaspora. We can chop up or separate into clusters later. Mm-hmm. But they are struggling to not just recruit African heritage males, but to retain them, support them, and graduate them. Mm-hmm. At the same time this is happening, the number of African heritage males that continues to decline is seeing the inverse with European American students being recruited, admitted, supported, and graduating from historically black colleges and universities and the predominantly black institutions. Please share your thoughts, your overview. I'm part of City University of New York's Black Male Initiative, mm-hmm. and every time I have opportunity to stand up, I salute our headquarters on West 57th Street, and I give love to the two schools in the CUNY system, York College in Queens and Medgar-Evers College in Brooklyn, that hold full member status in the Thurgood Marshall College Fund.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Very, very good question. And I would say the struggle is real in both contexts, in the PWI context, and it's real in the minority serving context. It's just a different struggle, and not a bad thing, but it's just it's an is thing. So I would say that for being an African-American male or black male in a historically black institution, black college and university, my struggle is not so, it's not about race or ethnicity or feeling like I'm not fitting along those lines. Yeah, I do share common cultural heritage, but even though I don't want to say that, you know, black folks are not a monolith, we're all very different. However, I don't have a lot of those struggles that I would have that I had down the road at Texas A&M. So it's not race and ethnicity, but sometimes in these contexts, it's a struggle that even though you're black, even though you're in the community, you know, you're among the community, but you're sometimes as perceived not being of the community in the sense that even though I'm a black male, but I'm a black male that was educated, that was trained in research one institutions. So I left Rutgers to come to Prairie View, not to come down, to come over to, but some people in their minds, they perceive that I don't fit, that I'm coming, that I represent, sometimes I represent this agenda that is not black, that an agenda that's about research, an agenda that's about some of these things that are not foreign to the HBCU context, but they're different. As the institutional context changes, all institutions are trying to move up on that Carnegie scale to the next level. And sometimes those of us who come from the outside, who come from those institutions, we're kind of othered in our own spaces, in the sense that I'm here, I'm black, but then are you truly black? Are your experiences, do they warrant us bringing you into the fold? So sometimes those are the challenges that I see and that I experience because I have been on the outside, and coming into the HBCU space, I'm sometimes treated as an outsider.
The only thing I would add, and I know that Fred, you know, has brought us together at some national conferences to talk about this is, one, I mean, the obvious sort of explanatory factor in the room is issues of masculinity, right? Broadly conceived. So, you know, at the HBCUs where I've worked, there are black heritage men on campus present. In fact, I was just having this conversation with a buddy of mine last night over dinner, so I'm glad you asked the question, Brother Dallas. But one is, you know, we will often think of them in athletics to recruit them for football, to recruit them for basketball, to recruit them for some team. But, you know, that same sort of mentality doesn't operate when we're thinking about who to recruit for the honors program, for the STEMS program, for the music department, for, you know, fill in the blank kinds of areas. So I think
for medicine,
for law, for theology. And I'm not talking about for the young men, because here's the thing we've got to remember is that there are young. A couple weeks ago, I was in Houston, Texas, doing some work with this nonprofit called Men, Inc. There were 18 young guys in the room. I'm talking between the ages of 8 and 18. You could not ask a question that the 8 to 12-year-old black guy didn't want to answer. His hand just, oh, can I answer twice? Pick me. But something happens between 10, 12, and 15 and up. Because you ask the 17-year-old, the 18-year-old, and they're too cool for school.
Yes, sir.
They cannot. I don't do that. You know, I as a musician, I thought I would do a community building activity with them. I said, hey, we're going to create a song. The 8-year-old, the 9-year-old was ready to start helping me out with it. I asked the 17, the 18-year-old, what part are you going to sing? No, I don't sing, bruh. You know, there's something that happened. And by the way, the problems that we're talking about, the forces are not within the, they're not resident within the young men. It's what schooling and the world does to them. That throws water on their most motivation and their aspiration and their interest and their freedom to express themselves without being labeled something. I think we got to deal with that because it happens in predominantly white, happens in historically black spaces. I teach a guy in my class right now in psychology who is brilliant. When you meet him, you wouldn't automatically think that. But when he opens up his mouth, he removes all doubt. And, you know, most people think of him for some sports team, but I'm thinking about him as a research associate. So how do we then take this understanding of masculinity, what it does, and then create spaces like the Black Male Initiative at CUNY and other places where guys can come and learn? And higher education is an awkward space, you know, for a traditional male, because you go into any classroom, professors love to say, hey, what did you think of the reading? Express what you feel about. Well, who teaches you how to express yourself? Especially when you were raised, probably, you know, with well and good intentions on, you know, that's not what men do. Ask a question. That's not what men do. If you're lost, anybody lost on the assignment, I'm willing to help you, but, you know, love my dad to pieces, but I watched my dad drive around lost most of my life and not ask people. But he would say, oh, I'm thirsty. He goes into the store. He's not going there to get a drink. He's going there to ask somebody, where in the world am I? Because it's not cool to have your whole family in the car and be lost. But it's normal. It's human, right? So who helps the man reconcile his masculinity with help seeking, with complexion, complications and expression? I think those are the lessons of the BMIs, but it shouldn't be up to the BMIs only. It's got to get down into the regular classroom and not just in higher ed. It's got to happen from kindergarten all the way up. That's what I would say that would help us then recruit them. If we can recruit them and then create supportive environments for them, we can retain them. And then we just re-enroll them until they graduate.
One of the open secrets across the 25 campuses that make up the City University of New York, all 25 campuses, with the exception of the Graduate Center, that's a conversation after this book talk is over. But our director told us that all the campuses have Black Male Initiative, but there are presidents from the top of each college that adamantly refuse to support the Black Male Initiative. Mm-hmm. It's twisted, sir. Yeah. It's twisted.
Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine it's going to be even more difficult as we sort of make our way into the new year. But, you know, again, I was just having this conversation with a colleague today on the phone. The language is perfect, right? Black Male Initiative. Whose responsibility is that? It can't be a program on a single campus. All of us as a society. Because what's happening to black men in higher education is not different from what we're observing to black men in society. And what's happening to black men in society is not different from what we see in K-12 or in law or in medicine. You know, I went on a little writing spree one point in my career where I was like, you know, I'm just going to go to every profession and study black men. I did it in medicine. I did it in veterinary medicine. I did it in law. in many of these professional fields that are high compensation, you know, well-respected professions, but they're struggling to not only get black men in, but keep them and graduate them. It's because we haven't figured out those lessons, and it's because we think that one program is going to do it all. No one program can do it all. No one parent can do it all. No one community can do it. It's going to take a web of support, as we said before. Thank you for that question.
Fred, do you have any thoughts? I know you study gifted black men and boys.
One of the things I'm actually working on that here at Prairie View. My current grant, if all of you have an opportunity to look it up, is titled BMST. That stands for Black Male STEM Teach. So the BMST grant focuses on getting more black men teaching STEM at the middle school level, or the middle grades level, as the literature refers to it. So we do know that less than 2% of our teachers in this country are black men. And when you look at STEM, it's less than 1%. And there's literature out there, research out there that shows that black students, not just males and females, but black males in particular, if they just have one teacher between kindergarten and like third to fifth grade, it dramatically increases their chances of going on to college and finishing high school. So the data is out there and it's real. But across the country, we're seeing, you know, this dearth in the number of black teachers. And we know that having role models, particularly having black male role models in the classroom in front of students, it really does a lot for student retention, for students graduating, them going on to college. So just very quickly, the research that I did to get this grant from the Kellogg Foundation back in 2017. So I did a search. At that time, Houston Independent School District was the fourth largest school district in the United States. So when I did the research, when you said black teachers, you got something like 1,800, 2,000. Then when you said black male teachers, it dropped down to something like 700. Then when you said black male teachers in STEM, it dropped down to something like 125. And then when you said black male teachers in STEM at the middle grades level, the middle school level, it dropped down to 9. There were 9 black men teaching STEM at the middle school level in the fourth largest school district in the United States. So if that's HISD, the same thing is going on in Miami. The same thing is going on in Tampa. The same thing is going on in Los Angeles. The same thing is going on in Tucson. So some of the issues, one of the major issues is how do we get more teachers? How do we get more teachers of color? In particular, how do we get more black male teachers? And I know that's only one piece of the overall puzzle. But some of the issues, some of the things that we're seeing, how do we change the narrative? One of my brother scholars is Dr. Gilman Whiting. He talks about a scholar identity. So how do we get black males to first see themselves as scholars? So before they're going to engage in the education enterprise, they first have to believe that they can be scholars. But before we can start there, you have to believe that they can be scholars. So it's a whole narrative. You know, it's a lot of stuff that's associated with improving the outcomes, improving the performance of all students, and particularly black students and black male students in particular.
My name is Sophie Delphius. Thank you so much for this incredible conversation. I'm born and raised in New York. I went to a PWI, Amherst College, for my undergrad. And hearing you all talk about belonging, you know, I remember entering as a young black woman, working class family, and recognizing what it meant to be first gen on campus and using activism as a means of survival. So when we talk about striving and belonging not being handed to you, it's really informed my life path. Now I work doing strategic planning consulting, focusing on community input, right? How to, especially for colleges, public sector, but really helping us find solutions for those who are being impacted day to day. What I loved about this book is when we talk about autoethnography, right, there's a way that you all as scholars, as faculty, really get to sit with your own process, your own journey, all while actively being mentors, people that, you know, students that I, like I was, I look to you, right? How do you all handle that tension of being somebody someone else looks to for support, maybe one of those, one anchor of the web you spoke to, Dr. Strayhorn? How are you thinking about belonging, especially, I'll name it, going into 2025, changing election? How do you see the opportunity you all have as people of color in these spaces with students who look to you? I know, because you all are brilliant. You too, Dr. Bonner, please weigh in. yes, I'll leave it there.
My daughter is committed to Amherst, and you know, I have, like, vicariously through her, I'm concerned about her sense of belonging, because she Chloe is on the autism spectrum. She's twice exceptional. She's a woman of color. She's brilliant. She has disabilities, but she also has super abilities, right? And thinking about the types of families those kids come from. There's a lot of wealth. There's a lot of, and very much, and she's not first gen. She's not, but I am concerned that she, you know, I'm worrying about her. Not the level of academics. She's going to flourish there. But when you said that, I've been thinking a lot lately about values. And I think values do change over time. I'll give you an example. When you get older, I think it's pretty reasonable to start valuing your health, right? So it's like, oh, I gotta take my heart medicine, or I gotta, right? I take medicine, you know? And so I think as you age, your values change. So where I'm at professionally and personally right now with kids going to college, you know, thinking about things, is my values around, why am I here? It's this existential moment. And I want to help those who come after me. So this whole notion of lifting as you climb, what does that really mean? Well, it means for me to be brave and use perhaps my station to help those who come after me. I've had this conversation with my elder mentors, and, you know, writing letters of recommendation, doing reviews, external reviews, because it's vital that we get those out there for those. So that's what I've been really thinking about lately as it relates to your question. Being encouraging to the junior faculty about, yes, you do belong here. We need you. Amplifying their work. And then also vulnerability, because it's hard. Even the eldest and the most senior. I was just telling Fred on the phone call, you know, when we're coming over here, and I'm like, oh, you know, we're going to miss you. And he's like, well, I'm here writing letters for my students. I'm like, well, it's a win-win. You can zoom in. You get those letters for your kids, because your students need those, right? So it's always being in service and communion with people. It's so important. It's a responsibility. And it's something, I think, to be quite honest, a younger me wasn't thinking about. But now where I'm at, I'm thinking more about that.
Yeah. So I think about this in similar kinds of ways. And I appreciate the question and the spirit of the question, right? So, you know, I am, professor, you know, I've gone through the tenure rank, and when I went, I went up early for tenure, and I didn't go up early because I chose to go up early. I didn't know you could go up early. My mentors didn't advise me. I was doing the work that I thought was important to do I was at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville at the time. I was, as a man of faith, I felt blessed and fortunate that the work that I was doing around student success and black men and student success was attracting students who wanted to come and study with me. You know, I did not come through a program that taught me how to recruit graduate students, how to build a research team. I observed some things. I mean, I picked up and I could talk to my professors about it, especially my doctoral advisor, but that I didn't, you know, come from these big research one. Although Virginia Tech was a research one, it was a very different experience for me. So when I get to my career and I'm watching stuff happen and I'm asking questions about how are you able to, and people are teaching me, they're giving me these gifts. I'm eager to put them into practice. And while putting them into practice, and then going to conferences and meeting students who say, I want to come to Tennessee to study with you. I thought, what a gift. Why in the world do you want to do that? But absolutely, come do it. And before you know it, you know, one's there and then another's there. And then they go out and they start recruiting. And so, you know, every single one of them, from James and Amanda, who's on the faculty at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, those are my first doctoral students. I still remember them. I still keep in touch with them. Amanda's a professor at the University of North Florida, all the way up to my most recent, and still actively work with students. For me, they become my academic family. You know, listen, I was just at a dinner last night talking to some colleagues. I don't know if this is true for everyone, but like I've had moms and dads come to my campus to interview me before they trust me with their doctoral student.
Wow. Nice.
Shout out to Dr. Tiffany Steele, whose grandma said, you know, you gonna listen, everybody can know, but this is my grandbaby. You got to take care of her. And so I know what it's like for families to trust you with their best, for you to do no harm and do good and support them. And so I don't know why that happens for me, but it raised this sensibility of responsibility for me that this is more than just a job. It is more than just an assignment. It's more than just a contract. That for me, it is part of my personal calling to, you said you're an activist. So I see myself too as an activist, but the way in which I act may be different from the way in which other people act. I'm striving to change the academy largely through the training and preparation of my students who come up thinking about their work in very different ways. Right. And then they go off and they become professors and they train a group of students who, before you know it, it proliferates and it builds. So to the heart of your question, how do I do it? I think I take it that way. I take it more, you know, so but to do it, I can't equip you for this journey if I'm not honest with you. And so my students know, even though I had a great run at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, I had tons of publications by the time I was advised by my provost to go up early. It was affirmed by my dean, almost immediately by my department chair. But I'll never forget the Saturday where I got the phone call and they said, the committee wants you to go through your resume and spell out your contribution to each of the publications. So even if you have 60, I don't know, 70, 30, whatever I had, right? Mm-hmm. But when did that become the rules of the game? And I'm talking to my colleagues saying, I was told to go through my resume and spell out, okay, on this publication, I conceptualized the study. I designed the survey. I analyzed the data. I wrote up the data analysis. And then, you know, I'm doing this for each one. And people are literally saying to me, they don't look like me, but they're saying, I never had to do that. No one's ever asked me to do that. And I've got to tell my students who look like most of us in this room, you will talk to people who say they never have to do that. But that's the space you're being equipped to enter. Mm-hmm. And it may very well be your journey. Mm-hmm. So here's what we got to do. We got to make sure that when you are asked to do this, you can be honest. And that's what gave me great pride. That when I sat down with my resume, yeah, it was extra labor. It was invisible labor. It was racial battle fatigue. It was unnecessary. It's unfair. It is inequitable. It's all those things. But at the end of the day, I could put that I designed the study because I know how to design a study. Mm-hmm. That I did develop the survey because I am an instrumental developer. That I did analyze the data, whether it's quantitative or qualitative. And that may shock people. And that's okay. You can be shocked. But I've got to be able to be honest with the students that I'm trying to equip to come into an academy that Fred said it at the very beginning, that they're trying to enter into a space that they have never been
And that's difficult because if you come into a space you've never been, you've got no repertoire. You don't have the vocabulary for moving through the space. Mm. You've got to acquire that. You don't have a pre-existing script. I love my mom and my dad, but my mom and dad could not tell me how to move through this academy. So you know what my mom and dad did? They came to Blacksburg, Virginia. And my mom is watching, so she'll be my trust in this. And she said, I got to meet with your doctoral advisor. My mom and dad told my doctoral advisor. I can only imagine the conversations they had late at night as I was moving through my doctoral program. My mom and dad said to my doctoral advisor, we've done all we can with Terrell. But now he's gotten to a point in his journey that we cannot carry him forward. He's going to a place we've never been. So we entrust him to you. The same way that families entrust their students to me. Mm. I watch the transaction. Mm. And I watch my mom and dad equip themselves for that moment to tell my doctor, listen, don't do any harm. If he gets to a point you don't want him, send him back home. We love him. We'll brush him off and he'll find. But they trusted other people, my doctoral advisors, my doctoral faculty, my mentor, Dr. Melvin Terrell, to coach me and guide me. And I know that I'm here partly because I had good grandparents, I had great, amazing parents, I had wonderful siblings, I got a great family that supports me at all times. But in addition to that, I've had an academic supportive network, right? People who knew better to help me get there. And so I owe it to pay it forward. And that, you know, that may never, I'll shut up on this point. I mean, it may never count, unfortunately, on my faculty activity report. I had a department chair tell me one time, why do you put all this on your faculty activity report? It does not count.
Oh, Lord.
And I told him, I said, what I learned, I didn't have the words earlier in my career, but at this point in my career, that without that, there is no this. Hmm. That if I don't, I'm an alpha. If I don't connect with the undergraduate alphas, they're my lifeline. If I don't have a place of worship for me, if I don't have students, if I don't have a research team, I die on the vine. Hmm. I cannot produce in this space without being connected to people who think about the world the way that you're talking about. So to everybody who feels, you know, disaffirmed or not affirmed in the academy, I hope tonight's lecture, if nothing else, it not just inspires you with good words, but it helps you, it affirms the importance of the work, right? Because I know for a fact that my students gave more to me than I'll ever probably give to them, and that makes it worth it.
Fred, you get the last word, brother.
I try to frame the work that I do, particularly this work, I try to frame it from a perspective or from a place, a positionality of authenticity. Let me put it that way. So I try to come from a positionality of authenticity. I'm not trying to manufacture an experience because I don't have to, because I'm going through it and it's real. So I'm not theorizing about my true experiences. That has been the problem many times when folks outside of the Black and Brown and Asian diaspora who try to tell our stories, they're theorizing. I'm talking about an authentic experience. And so often the academy wants you to believe that those who theorize about me are more valid than me who is having the original experience. So that is what I am trying to debunk, dispel, to disabuse communities of thinking that what I'm telling you, because some of it is anecdotal, but all of it is authentic. So trying to share that I don't need to I shouldn't have to push myself into the room to share my original experience. I shouldn't have to move or push to the side people who are trying to tell my narrative when I'm here with the authentic documents. I'm coming with the Dead Sea Scrolls. I have it. I'm talking about the original documents. So I don't need you to narrate to do a revisionist history of a history that I have lived. So that is what I try to do, is come from a position of authenticity, a positionality of authenticity.
Thank you to Drs. Hartlip, Strayhorn, and Bonner for a wonderful and enlightening presentation. You can purchase the book, Belonging in Higher Education, from the Rutledge website. The paperback is available for $42.39. There's currently a discount on it. And the link is available on tonight's talk webpage. And for those of you online, I did drop the link into the chat. And enjoy the rest of your Friday evening. Happy holidays, and looking forward to seeing all of you again at ARRI in 2025. Thank you.